Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, episode 64.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem.
Oh, I'm going to kill the bear. Say it, I'm going to kill the bear. Say it, I'm going to kill the bear. Say it. Say I'm going to kill the bear. Say it.
I'm going to kill the bear.
Say it again.
I'm going to kill the bear.
And again. I'm going to kill the bear. Good. What one man can do, another can do.
What one man can do, another can do.
Say it again.
What one man can do, another can do.
And again.
What one man can do, another can do.
Yeah. You're goddamn right. Today, I'm going to kill the motherfucker.
Sometimes I tell the boy old stories of courage and justice. Difficult as they are to remember. All I know is the child is my warrant. And if he is not the word of God, then God never spoke.
Hello and welcome to the Plain Label Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Williams, and along with me is my good friend and co-host, Mrs. Rachel Zelag.
What up, Leia?
In this episode, we are beginning our new theme of survival films, and joining us this month is our frequent guest, Mr. Cameron Rice.
I'm not gonna kill the motherfucker.
Yeah. In this episode, we are taking a look at the films Apollo 13, The Edge, and The Road. Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that we are proud members of the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. Mrs. Zelag, drink roll call. What do you have for me?
I'm on the deck drinking a shandy.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Just a Line and Kugel summer shandy?
Yep.
All right. Cameron, how about you?
I got coffee with some Kahlua and a little bit of a Bailey's Irish Cream.
Smart. Nice. I am... Apparently, we should hit them up for our sponsorship. I'm also having something from Line and Kugel's, and I figured it was appropriate for our discussion. It is called the Canoe Paddler.
Nice.
Yeah, which is... It's a Kolsch style with rye lager.
Good.
It's pretty good. I think I prefer the shandy, but it's not bad. Wow. So there you go. So with that, we are going to begin our discussion with 1995's Apollo 13.
Apollo 13 flight controllers, give me a go, no go for launch.
You know that Easter vacation trip we had planned for Acapulco?
Uh-uh.
Procedures.
Go.
Control.
Go flat.
There might be a slight change in destination.
Really?
Maybe say the moon.
Booster.
Go.
Retro.
We're go flat.
GNC.
We're go.
And I take the controls and I steer it around.
FAO.
We're go flat.
For a nice, soft landing on the moon. Better than Neil Armstrong.
Does it bother you that the public regards this flight as routine?
It's nothing routine about flying to the moon. I can vouch for that.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
The clock is running!
Houston, we have cleared the tower at 1313.
Okay, guys. We're going to the moon.
This is the crew of the Apollo 13. Wishing everyone back on Earth a pleasant evening.
Houston, we have a problem.
We got a wicked shimmy up here.
Houston, we are venting something out into space. It's definitely a gas of some sort.
It's like the heart rates are skyrocketing.
The Apollo 13 spacecraft is apparently losing breathing oxygen. The emergency has ruled out any chance of a lunar landing.
Why are there so many people here?
Something broke on your daddy's spaceship.
I have a request from the news people.
Take it up with my husband. He'll be home on Friday.
Flight, we have lost the radio contact.
Econ, what's your data telling you?
It's reading a quadruple failure. That can't happen. It's got to be instrumentation.
The ship's bleeding to death.
This rate, we're going to skip right out of the atmosphere, and we're never going to get back.
Well, we're looking at less than 15 minutes of life support in the Odyssey.
We never lost an American in space. We're sure as hell not going to lose one on my watch.
Odyssey, do you read me?
How long does it take to power up the LEM?
3 hours by the checklist.
We don't have that much time.
Based based on the true story of the ill-fated 13th Apollo mission bound for the moon, astronauts Lovell, Hayes, and Swigert were scheduled to fly Apollo 14 but are moved up to 13. It's 1970 and America have already achieved their lunar landing goals, so there's little interest in this routine flight. Until, that is, things go very wrong and prospects of a safe return fade.
Mm-hmm. So, before getting into this in particular, this is a Cameron's idea to do survival films. So what, since we're having them on this month, what is it about the survival films that you wanted to talk about in general, or why this theme for us?
Well, I think the thing about it was originally the theme we'd kind of been bandying about for a couple months now is, was it You're Gonna Hate This or something like that? Yeah. It's just to be challenging films. And the problem was I kept coming up with films that would challenge. I kept coming up with films that were gonna challenge Rachel, but I was having a hard time coming up with films to challenge Eric. So I was like, well, that'll just be called Mean Month at that point. So let me try to think of something else. And so the other idea I came up with is survival films. And the reason was is like, I tend to really enjoy these kind of, people trapped in nature, or trapped in some kind of thing, film. And the movies that sprang to mind are one of the movies we're going to talk about, but there's also movies like The Gray, The River Wild, the Meryl Streep canoe movie with crazy Kevin Bacon.
Oh yeah, we did that one.
So all these kinds of films, and what I tend to like about them is that it tends to have that you have to completely – you're like – it's one of those movies that's like it's completely in the moment. You know what I mean? And they tend to take place like in one day or 2 days. There are the exceptions. And they also tend to be, which I think is something interesting we could probably talk about once we're done with all the films at the end of the month, is like why these tend to be mostly not all the time, but mostly male-centric movies.
Mm, that's a very good point. That's something that I thought of earlier today, and so I think I'm actually going to change my selection for the next show into something different.
But okay.
But that is something that I thought of.
But I think I have my reasons why I think that is too. But like I said, we can discuss that at the end of this whole thing.
Sure. Because
women wouldn't get themselves in that kind of situation.
Meryl Streep.
Yeah, that's true. In our last film, there's a woman who decides not to get herself in that situation also.
See?
So there you go. So Apollo 13, this was Rachel's selection. So so why this,
Cruz? Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks. A very young, I hadn't seen this in a long time.
I
was like, wow, is he young looking?
I was expecting I guess I didn't remember. I hadn't seen this for a while. And I was expecting more like Castaway-ish looking Tom Hanks, but this is like Turner and Hooch Tom Hanks.
Yeah, very thin in the face.
Yeah.
Well, this is coming off of, at this time, he had just done Philadelphia 2 years beforehand where he'd lost a ton of weight. And then the year after that was Forrest Gump where that character runs constantly.
Touche. Mm.
So he's doing like two movies in a row where it's like, be rail stick thin. So I'm sure he was like, and I don't know how long between Forrest Gump ending filming and Apollo 13 begins filming, but I think release date wise, they're only a year apart.
Wow.
Yeah, it was Philadelphia 93, Forrest Gump 94, Apollo 13 95.
Wow, he's just dominating the 90s.
Well, there's even a joke on, he hosted SNL that year, and there's even a joke, this is around the time of the Academy Awards, and Nicolas Cage had just won for Leaving Las Vegas, and yep. Tom Hanks' opening monologue was like, well, I guess I'll read you what my speech would have been had I won for Apollo 13, because he'd won the 2 years prior. And the whole speech was like, Nicolas Cage, this should have been yours!
Nice.
Thing. I'd highly recommend looking up that SNL monologue.
That's good.
Funny.
So what is it about this movie that made you want to revisit it, Cruz? Is this something that you were a big fan of at the time, I'm guessing? And
Yeah, I hadn't seen it for a really long time, and so that was one of the reasons. I was like, well, I can watch this, and I mean, Cameron was right. He knew he was going to be, but, most of these survival movies, I want to poke myself in the eye. So I was trying to find one that wasn't just two dudes hanging out camping. So I was trying to do, like, think outside the box, because I told you I was going to make you watch, Mean Girls.
Oh, right, because it was high school survival. Right.
And you were like, no. So I just wanted to do one that wasn't, like, that was, I mean, it's still technically man versus nature, but it's not quite as woodsy. Mm-hmm. So that's why this one.
Okay. And what did you think on the rewatch?
It was a little more, let me think of the words. It was like Remember the Titans-y a little bit more than I remember. Cause like, I remember in 1995, I was like 11.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh my gosh, this is super serious. But you can tell, I could tell on the rewatch where they're trying to, you know, like pull at your heartstrings. Obviously just painting Tom Hanks as like the ultimate husband and father kind of a deal. It was
more manipulative than you remember
it
being.
It's a little bit more Disney than I remember it being, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I mean, okay. It was still a good movie.
Okay. Cameron, what did you think of this one?
I am so glad Rachel just said what she said. So had you asked me like a month or two ago, how is Apollo 13? I'd say it's an excellent movie. But this has also probably been about 10 years since I've watched it. And it's still a very, very good movie. But yeah, it's very interesting. I looked up who the screenwriters of this film, who wrote this movie. Cause, you know, at the time this was a huge movie. It was like nominated for an Academy Award. So it's like, sure. Who worked on this? I was halfway expecting to see like Dean Koontz, like one of the Spielberg guys that, you always see. And actually that was not the case. The guy, it's two different screenwriters. One of them went on to go write, Castaway and Jarhead, and those two films. And the other guy wrote, Final Fantasy, The Spirit, Within.
Is that the one we watched?
Yeah, that's the one we watched.
Oh God.
So that makes me think, that, although actually the main thing probably to notice, that screenwriter wrote, he directed, For All Mankind, which is a documentary on the first moon landing. It's on Criterion. It's probably how he got the job. But what's interesting is that this almost feels like two movies where, and it kind of is, it's the mission and then the post-mission. The pre-mission does feel very Remember the Titans. Characters often refer to each other by their first and last names. There's dream sequences. Mm-hmm. Characters tend to talk to each other in expository-like dialogue so that the audience knows what's going on.
Yeah.
And then the second half of the movie, once they're in, the mission's happening, basically once Ed Harris shows up on the screen.
Right, you don't fuck around.
Yeah, there's a lot less expository dialogue. Things are just happening, and part of me almost feels like I feel like this is when the screenwriter of Jarhead took over.
They were mad at each other, so they just split it up into three ways, and like they each took a section and handed it in. Yeah,
and it became very matter of fact. So yeah, because I too thought like, I didn't think this was a docudrama kind of movie where it's like it's so realistic. But in my head, I remember thinking there was like at least some of that to it. But then when the dream sequences start showing up and some of the dialogue, one of my favorite things that I caught was when Gary Sinise is on this like grassy hill watching the shuttle take off, and he's the only one on this grassy hill.
Yes,
yeah. No big deal, but it just made me laugh. Like it takes away what would be the realism of this movie. I'm like,
right, like please God, feel feelings about what's going on right now.
Yes, but saying that, there are things I like. I do like the relationship between Lovell and his wife in the movie. The woman who plays Tom Hanks' wife,
right?
Yeah, Catherine Quinlan
is very good. I love Clint Howard.
Mm-hmm.
And his scientist role with like his headset like taped onto his glasses.
Do you like picture like their mom being like, Ronnie, let your brother in this movie? Aw, mom.
Well, that's interesting. Is that to a point, Clint Howard appeared in all of Ron Howard movies, I think up until whatever he did next. I think he wasn't in them for a while. Then he did have a small role in Cinderella Man.
Yeah, he was in The Grinch.
Oh, yeah. Oh, what a terrible movie. but I think it's interesting, I think, too, to watch this movie because so maybe some behind the curtain. There was like maybe a month or two ago where mine and Eric's show Filmographies, we were approaching it to do another director. And Eric, you'd brought up doing Ron Howard.
Right. Yeah.
And I remember at the time kind of thinking like, and I want to say that it's not because I dislike Ron Howard, but I don't know if there's like a narrative generally to Ron Howard's filmography.
Hmm.
And that is to say, like, there's no shot in any, every director, or most like name directors, tend to have a style or something they do. You know, Kubrick is very mathematically, the frame is very thought out. Spielberg has the dolly and shot in people's faces. There's no Ron Howardian shots. Mm-hmm. Like people, you wouldn't watch a movie and go, man, this is a real Ron Howard. That's his Ron Howard shot right there. From some new director. And also, again, going to Spielberg, Spielberg films tend to have something about fathers, whether the father be absentee or, the movie's about a father and how he's dealing with his family. Most directors have stories they return to. Sam Peckinpah has, you know, the men who the world is leaving them behind and all these kind of things. Ron Howard doesn't really have that.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wonder if that comes from starting off as a child actor. Like being in the business for so long that
you think there'd be more like gingers in his movies or something.
maybe one or two. So I think that's the sort of interesting thing about watching Ron Howard movies is none of them are bad, but they are all the right kind of popcorn movie. You know, they're not stupid. You're not going to leave the theater feeling stupid, but you definitely never leave the theater feeling challenged.
Yeah,
I mean, his most challenging movie might be the Da Vinci Code, so that might tell you something.
Well, yeah, that or like I think I like A Beautiful Mind.
I think there's movies that he makes that are amazing and that, you know, you can love, but that's sort of why I kind of veto doing Ron Howard is I'm like, it'll just become like, do you like this one? Yeah. Do you like this one? Mm-hmm. No.
Gotcha.
And that's sort of, and Apollo 13 is probably his most respected as far as, cause I love Willow. Backdraft is great. This actually movie feels a lot like Backdraft. It just happens to have the prestige of being nominated for an Oscar, but it's equally as dramatic. You know, the only thing is it doesn't have an awesome Donald Sutherland performance.
Yeah, it's not as naughty either. Like, it doesn't have that, like, good old boy thread to it either.
Well, sure, because it's set in the 70s and it's kind of clean. It's, like, cleaned up.
Yeah.
Almost like a sitcom would be from the time right. Where everything is real pristine.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Except for the daughter, you know, to where they try to have the one daughter be a little bit rebellious.
Right, and I feel that's just kind of like a, we need to put something in there.
But... yeah, we need to have a nod to them.
Yeah,
and it's one of those things. But I mean, it's hard too because I think when it comes to that era and the idea of landing on the moon and all that stuff, like I will admit, I'm somebody who, like, I love documentaries about moon and space exploration. Like, that stuff does kind of get to me in a way, and I think it's maybe hard to fictionalize that kind of stuff and not have it seem hokey. Because at the end of the day, it's all a very aspirational kind of,
yeah,
we can do it, it's the best of mankind, and look what we can do. And so I have no problem with a movie like this being hokey. And it feels very like throwbacky. Like, it kind of reminds me of like movies from like the 50s or 60s when they talked about real events. Like, if someone made a Titanic movie in the 50s, it would probably be very hokey. Everyone would use each other's full names and things of that nature. So I have no problem with that. It's just, it's very interesting having had a lot of time away from the movie and coming back to it and thinking I thought what the movie was one thing and coming back to it.
Yeah, I guess I thought, I didn't really have as much of a problem. Like, I've seen this movie so many times. Like, we had this VHS
totally
at the golf course and it was on and just, you know, cause it's a Ron Howard film in that it's for general audiences. It's going to have most of the time it's going to have a positive, uplifting message and ending. And it's just completely unoffensive.
Right. And I didn't have a problem with it. I just didn't remember it. I guess I just.
You didn't remember it being like that.
Yeah.
And so what I thought was interesting and why I really wanted to have it be paired with my pick was that I think it's very by the numbers and very like, oh, everyone will go home happy to where, and it's not a challenging film like you'd mentioned earlier, Cameron. And so that's why I thought it would be a nice contrast compared to a film that is a little different than that we'll discuss later.
Yeah.
But I, you know, that all being said, like with my familiarity with it and all that, it had been a while since I'd seen it and I loved it. Like, I had a great time watching it.
Yeah, it's really, you know, and even in the intense scenes, you know, they're all in the control room and they're, you know, true to form, doing a good job explaining to the audience what's going on and what needs to happen in order to set the tension for the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like when they're just staring at those numbers like 200, 100, and zero, you know, and they explain to you, like, inadvertently, like, what happens if the oxygen, you know, they don't have, you know, and so you get it and you're in with them. And they help you play along, I guess.
Sure, and it's technical enough to where you realize, holy shit, these guys are really smart, but they give you enough to let you know that it's really complicated.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, and there's always like one that's like, give it to me straight, and then they tell idiots like me can be like, oh, okay, this is what we're hoping for. This mm-hmm. is crossing my fingers.
And so what it ultimately amounts to for me, and I think this is true with a lot of Ron Howard films for me, is that it relies heavily upon your feeling for the cast.
Yeah.
Like how you feel this cast is, whether you like them or don't like them, or you're like, oh, you know, this guy's kind of a shit, you know,
right.
Because Bill...
If it was Ben Affleck, I wouldn't even care.
Right. Like Bill Paxton's like a little bit of an ornery guy.
Yeah.
At times,
oh,
you know.
I love that he pukes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And we have that and Swigert, you know, being the ladies' man, but he's kind of like, you know, you get to see a little bit of that, and you get to see Tom Hanks just being kind of the stock, perfect at everything guy.
Right.
So I don't know. I wouldn't say identify, but I really latch on to these characters. And, you know, anytime the film requires me to feel the feelings, then I was completely with it. Like, I had no problems going back to when I first watched it and was just, you know, getting welled up when the grandma's talking about if, you know, they made a washing machine that could fly, my Jimmy could land it.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. I'm like, oh, they're going to be okay. You know, and just feeling that sort of thing that I don't typically do when a film is manipulating me like that. And I don't know if it's just a little bit more of a lighter touch than some other films, or if I'm just so familiar with this film or I don't notice it, or I'm not disturbed by it, or...
Yeah, or you're just so familiar with the characters, it's like you're just... I get what you're saying, because yeah. Like that's kind of like it is for me. You know, this is an old movie, and I watch it from the very beginning. So like every time you see him, you're like, ah, Swigert or whatever the hell his name is, like, quit trying to put the beer bottle in the cup and get the ladies. Like,
yeah, it's real. It's just a real comforting, familiar yeah. feeling sort of movie.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess that's why it's, at least for me, it was real sparse on the notes, because I was like, well. This wasn't something where I was like, oh, let's look at their motivations and find out this, that, and the other, and
yeah.
And really kind of try to analyze it. It was just like, oh, okay, I'll just sit back and watch it, and I can kind of turn my brain off. And so that doesn't necessarily make for great analysis, but it's a good time. I recommend watching this one.
Yeah, I think for me, what it is, and I will say right now, not enough good things can be said about how awesome Ed Harris is.
But great. He's so good in this.
I have a thing for Ed Harris. I love Ed Harris. I think the Abyss easily could have gone into survival films as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly just because I love the Abyss. But yeah, I think what it is for me is that like once like the mission starts and they are like from liftoff onwards, I think this movie's awesome and firing on all cylinders. I think for me, what it kind of is
intended.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think what it is the stuff beforehand, all the Earth stuff, like, I totally get why it's there. It's all character building, and so we understand what's happening. But there's also that sense where it's like, outside of the daughter having a fit and being like, I want to dress this way, no one else tends to be having, like, a normal conversation that isn't about the mission.
Yeah. That's true.
The wife is talking about the other astronauts' wives and all this other stuff, and there's a small part of me that's like, okay, you spent 45 minutes on people talking about the mission. Can someone have just a human conversation? It doesn't have to be about dinner, but just that small part where it starts to feel like people are talking in platitudes to some extent. Where it's, well, like, here's information you need to know in an hour.
Yeah, and it's definitely a case of some of the characters don't seem very realistic. Like, Tom Hanks, to me, is just this ideal character. And that's fine, but it's not someone that I could, you know, particularly identify with.
Right. Well, one of my notes, because I didn't take very many notes either, One of my notes was the wife is either spunky or a problem, and in this movie, they all seem to be either invisible or spunky. Mm. Like, had this been another director or somebody else was in on the script writing, maybe one of the wives was, like, really pissed that he was bumped up and going to, you know, like, there could have been, like, mission talk that was there where one of the wives was putting her foot down and was super pissed and not talking to him, you know, a little bit more drama before we go up there and stuff like that. I just noticed, you know, like, and, you know, granted, they didn't really, they wanted to focus enough time on the characters to make you root for them when they got up there, but they probably didn't want to waste a whole lot of time before they got up to the whole point of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, that's kind of what, I mean, it does feel like they probably had a bunch of dialogue and then they just edited a bunch of it out. It's like, you know what, we just don't have time to put that shit in there.
Because it's a long enough of a film. I mean, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes. It doesn't feel like it's that long of a movie to me, though.
No.
Like, it moves along. And one of the things that I did really like is that it reminds me almost of a little bit of, like, a video game to where you have these little minor problems that you have to figure out.
Kind of, yeah.
And it's like, oh, shit, now that the filter's all messed up, well, how are we going to fix the filter? And then that's done, and we're like, but now the real threat is the heat shield, and how are we going to figure that out, you know?
Right.
It's just like each thing was like a little minor boss that you had to beat before you got to the big ending.
Sure, that's funny.
For movie buffs, there's a cameo from Roger Corman.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, he's the I think it's the senator getting a tour from Tom Hanks who's like, why are we spending all this money? We've already been to the moon.
How do you pee?
Yep, that's Roger Corman, which is pretty cool. And I think for me, the best thing about this movie is, because it did so well, it got Tom Hanks to go make From the Earth to the Moon, the HBO miniseries, which is fantastic.
I haven't seen it.
I haven't either.
Oh, my God. And so for me, it's far more like, it's 10 episodes and it deals with the beginning of the space missions up until I think like the 80s.
Oh, nice.
And it's awesome. It's basically, it's because that did really well, and then him and Spielberg went and made Saving Private Ryan, and because From Earth to the Moon did well, he was able to go make Band of Brothers.
Hmm. I have seen that many times.
So I would highly recommend From the Earth to the Moon.
Right. Sounds good. All right. Well, do either one of you have anything else about Apollo 13 before we move on?
Not really. Sometimes when Bill Paxton talked, all I could see was Chet from Weird Science. But that's about it.
I always think of his character from Aliens.
Oh, yeah. sort of the same guy.
Same thing.
Your butthead.
Ugh.
Yeah. Say hi to your mom for me. That guy.
That was Biff.
Yeah, I know. It's the same sort of person, though. Okay, so moving on, we're going to discuss Cameron's film, and it is 1997's The Edge.
Okay, check it, please.
A photographer with an eye for beauty.
Okay, great. Let's do one more.
Nice looking lady. Your wife?
Yes. Why'd you ask?
A man of wealth who lives through books.
Charles knows everything. Got a question, ask him.
I seem to retain all these facts, but putting them to any useful purpose is another matter.
Each the essence of the civilized man.
Well, Charles, we're going on an impromptu adventure. You come too.
All that money, never knowing what people value you for. I think your wife's pretty cute too.
So, how are you planning to kill me?
Hold on!
But when civilization disappears...
Why do we even think they'll come looking for us?
Our friend's a billionaire. You know what happens when you misplace one?
Why?
All they have is each other to rely on.
Most people lost in the wilds, they die of shame because they didn't do the one thing which would have saved their lives. Thinking.
Their will to survive. And the question...
Why would I want to kill you, Charles? Why would I want to do that?
For my wife.
Of where the greatest danger lies.
Saved my life.
Well, I couldn't kill you with Steven around. I'd have to kill him too, and he's the only one that knows how I like my coffee.
What are we gonna do, Charles? What? Am I supposed to have a plan?
We
rich man. All anybody wants is take something from you when they want it bad enough to kill you.
You and my wife? I've seen you with her.
20th Century Fox presents Academy Award winner Anthony Hopkins.
You want to die out here, huh?
Alec Baldwin.
Money, folk. Sit up there, drinks and golf, but get you in an emergency. And you bloom. You make me sick.
I'm sure I do.
Somewhere between the law of the wild and the nature of man lies the edge.
I'm not going to die. It's today. I'm going to kill the mother.
A model has her rich, much older husband come with her to a photo shoot, but when their plane crashes in the middle of nowhere, a strong mind game erupts between the clever husband and the jealous young photographer as they try to get back to civilization.
Okay, so this is...
The model is not the main character of this movie.
No, it is not.
Judged by that description.
So this is Cameron's selection. This was one that right away it was, oh, we're definitely doing this one. And I'll think about the other one, is what I remember the selection being. So what is it about this movie that you wanted to bring up and to discuss?
The fact that for me, I love The Edge. The Edge, I don't know why, you know, I think when you're a kid, there's always those movies like that, I don't know what kids are of this generation are gonna say, but like, there's always those movies that's like, for whatever reason, you really wanted to see it. It didn't have superheroes or anything like that. It wasn't a big action movie. But there was something about either the trailers or the commercials that totally grabbed you. And for whatever reason, when I was a kid, the trailer for The Edge totally grabbed me. And so I remember I saw it in the theater. I rented it when it came out on VHS. And this is just a movie like I just really enjoy. And I feel like it's a movie that like, cinephiles kind of remember, but like the general public has kind of forgotten. And it's interesting because it stars Anthony Hopkins only like 2 years removed from Silence of the Lambs, 2 or 3 years removed from Silence of the Lambs. Alec Baldwin at his like most in shape Alec Baldwin in this. And for me, the big thing is that it was written by David Mamet.
Right.
And once you know it's written by David Mamet, it becomes very obvious watching the movie that it was written by David Mamet. So I love this movie, and this is the kind of movie, like, it's one of those movies, like, I love to kind of just suggest to people if they're into this kind of thing.
Okay.
So when the idea of survival films came to me, I'm like, well, we got to do The Edge.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, this was a first watch for me. I had not seen it. I'm guessing, Rachel, you hadn't seen it either, right?
Right.
Okay. It was a film that, on the whole, I enjoyed on watching it now compared to maybe in 97 or 98. I think that the disservice was, for me, not seeing it when I was 17 or 18. Because when I watched it now, I think Rachel and I may have even had a discussion about this, but it was right from the beginning. I was like, oh, okay, so... Al McPherson's got this plan and Alec Baldwin's going to kill Anthony Hopkins.
Right.
Right away. That's the first thing I thought of. And not to say that things weren't like I really enjoyed a lot of aspects of it, but the overall idea behind it and the overall, like, I guess I didn't know, you know, this is my own fault, but I guess I didn't hear or pick up that they were in Alaska right away. Like, I thought that they were in either, like, Colorado or somewhere like that.
Yeah, I didn't catch that either.
And so I was like, well, I get that it's a long walk, but, I mean, it's not like this is the middle of nowhere, I thought.
Okay, well, that's not in the movie.
And so I didn't see it.
They could have Apollo 13'd it, I guess, and said Alaska 800 times.
Well, and so I was just like, huh, okay, well, it seems like they've got a long way to go, and there's, like, these grassy areas, and I was like, well, this isn't so bad, and then there's... You know, some mountainous areas where they're wearing the bear skin and all that stuff. Okay. But yeah, so I would say that I enjoyed it. I would say that I wasn't in love with it though. I already know what you think about it, Cruz. So, what is it that you had problems with about?
Well, I mean, it wasn't the worst. I mean, we all know the worst movie I've ever seen, but, it was just, it wasn't problems. It was very 1997.
Oh, okay. What do you mean by that?
It was very, like, gosh. I mean, there were some, Like, you know, they're all in the plane and we have all of our cliche characters. And I thought it was actually going to be more, like a group, setting, but then after a while it was just those two. So they probably just cliched those other characters because they didn't want to have to deal with like building.
Yeah. You didn't want to waste time.
So that makes more sense to me. Cause like right at the beginning, I'm like, oh God, if we're going to have to deal with this glasses lady the whole time, I'm going to punch myself in the face. But I mean, like, if you think that Alec Baldwin might be sleeping with your wife, he's probably sleeping with your wife. Like, I mean, you don't have to like, and Anthony Hopkins knows that like right off the bat. It was just kind of a weird movie because like, I wonder who came up with this idea of this whole script. Like, this old guy has to go into the woods and he's kind of like MacGyverish. Mm-hmm. Super smart. He brought a book and apparently knows everything there is to know about the woods. And then, like, there's the whole cheating with the... I mean, it's just kind of a weird scenario. And then they have, you know, the token black guy.
Just... Oh, poor Michael. We were in the middle of rewatching Lost, and so I was like, oh, Harold, Michael's back, and he's in the middle of nowhere. And he's and this time his fate is not so good.
And I knew him, he's Mercutio from Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's...
I remember him from the handicapped guy from Oz.
Or or the Matrix sequels.
Yeah, man, he's got some good roles, thinking about it. Yeah,
he's in a lot more than you think, surprisingly.
So, I mean, I wasn't, like, I wasn't rolling my eyes during this, but at the end of the movie, I didn't really feel feelings about anyone dying or anything like that. I wasn't, oh my gosh, they're BFFs now, or you know, anything like that. So it just, maybe like you said, if I would have watched it earlier on, I would have had maybe a little more of a memory of having it be, you know, something it, I thought it was earlier, I guess.
Okay.
Well, I think it is important for this movie. I would also recommend maybe a rewatch, but it's like, I think for this movie it's important to keep in mind too that it is a David Mamet script. Despite who directed it, the director was Lee Tamahori, who, I'll be honest, he hasn't made a good movie since. But David Mamet, his milieu tends to be two things. Is that A, it's intelligent men doing something, whatever that thing is. But it tends to be very intelligent men. The dialogue tends to be very...
like a play.
Because yeah. he started off as a playwright. It tends to be very short bursts of dialogue. Like, people don't tend to have like big speeches. I'm gonna kill the motherfucker isn't so much a speech. It's much more of a call response with him and Alec Baldwin. And there tends to be a con involved in his, work. So whether that be in something like Homicide, where there is like a legitimate con, like people are tricking each other, or in something like Glengarry Glen Ross, where it involves essentially Jack Lemmon trying to get the Glengarry papers. Mm-hmm. And con his way to get them. But his movies tend to feature the most manliest of men, short dialogue and cons. And I think for me, David Mamet doing that in a survival film with a bear, it's still the exact same thing, where like Anthony Hopkins is the most intelligent person, Alec Baldwin is the best photographer, and they just butt heads against each other, much like Kevin Spacey and Al Pacino and Glengarry Glen Ross, and other Mamet works. And the con is, I brought you out here to kill you so I can have your wife. Mm-hmm. I don't give a fuck what we've gone through. I'm still going to kill you. I'm going to get what I want to get, which is also a very Mamet thing. One of Mamet's famous quotes, and it might not even be an original Mamet quote, but maybe quotes he's attributed to someone else, but he says, people enjoy watching other people be good at what they do.
Right.
Okay.
So,
and that,
I think for me with The Edge, what it is it's the idea of Anthony Hopkins is somebody who, he's never gone through this experience, but he's smart and he knows how to deal with most of this in some capacity. And then also just awesome fucking beards. There are some great beards as this movie goes on. And I love a lot of the dialogue. Alec Baldwin getting fucking mad at Anthony Hopkins, being like, "Now here you bloom." Like, I love all that stuff. And the bear is awesome in this movie. Bart the Bear, who had appeared in a number of movies. I think this is the movie he's ever been the most vicious in.
Yeah, they did. You know, they have an interesting Wikipedia page about this film. And that was one of the things that that Alec Baldwin had been quoted about, how he was impressed that they were able to make the bear look so scary. Because the bear is so docile and just such a kindly kind of a Kodiak bear, but boy, it looks fucking vicious in this.
Oh, you gotta imagine you probably did not need much inspiration when you're running.
No.
If there's a big fucking Chris
man,
bear
it's a big fucker
you.
Too.
And I think Eric, I don't know if LQ Jones having a brief part in this movie,
mm-hmm.
Who is a Sam Peckinpah regular back in the day.
Sure.
And I love the idea that it's like, for me, that Anthony Hopkins is essentially like he's a billionaire, but he's kind of ineffectual and people take advantage of him. And all this other stuff, like the fact that LQ Jones is like basically wants to start like a forest theme park in his little area, and he's like, it only costs about $20 or $30 million, and Anthony Hopkins just goes,
Right, he just walked away.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I guess here's sort of the thing that I have, and it's not a David Mamet thing in general. I don't think I have a problem with this. But for me, I don't like it. I was saying earlier about how I really latched on to the cast of Apollo 13. And here, I watched the film and, you know, I think obviously Anthony Hopkins is a great actor and Alec Baldwin's kind of up and down for me. But I think that, these characters, I didn't give a shit about either one of them.
Yeah, I didn't either.
And my problem is Anthony Hopkins is this guy who at one point says, you know, something to the effect of he's going to change his life and he's going to be a different person. And this is when they're, you know, stranded and it's just the two of them. And Alec Baldwin kind of encourages him to do that. And I'm watching the movie going, well, what's the problem? Like, it's not like he's a jerk off. It's not like Anthony Hopkins is having this large character arc from my vantage point. It seemed like he, you know, another one of the Wikipedia things was this was called Bookworm, before it was called The Edge. And it was just about a guy who reads a lot and just knows a lot of stuff.
What's wrong with that?
And nothing. And so then he gets, you know, put out in the wilderness to kind of test what happens when it becomes a reality.
See, and that's where I am like, so I like that, because like one of my notes was reading books is important, because he seems very smart and he is reading this book the whole time and he's, you know, very well read. He apparently knows everything there is to know about everything, and you put him in the middle of the woods and he's going to be able to problem solve. My problem is with Alec Baldwin's character, this like, I mean, like, I feel like there should have been some sort of like mental breakdown where he was completely out of his element, but he seems to just be like egoing along on sure bullshit, which is like, I think probably, you know, what his character would have been doing. But that, I mean, like, I guess are we supposed to like them together as buddies right before the end? Or, I mean, like, are they always supposed to be butting heads? I guess, 'cause like, that's where, you know, there are like moments between them where they're having like actual conversation and I'm like, they're never going to be best friends. So like, I guess.
I think it's supposed to be like this push pull kind of thing where we're supposed to think, these two and which is a very, playwright kind of thing, especially when you only have two characters, which is like, these two hate each other. They get along now. They hate each other again. One of them likes the other. And it's this tends to be back and forth. And then you just kind of pick what setting you're going to be in. Are you going to be in one room? Are you going to be in the wilderness? Are you going to be in space, wherever you're going to be? But, if commonly the two character thing with playwrights, if it's not like The Odd Couple, which even The Odd Couple is like, they're fighting and they're pissed. Now they're getting along and now they're cool and fuck you now, you. Oscar.
But one of them wasn't banging the other one's wife and trying to kill him.
True, but that Anthony Hopkins knowing that's a fact is not revealed until the third act.
Right.
He has definite suspicions, but the whole movie, you know, goes about trying to basically say that though Anthony Hopkins is an intelligent person, he even has the line of dialogue. It's like, I know all this stuff, but, you know, could I put it to any practical good use? So it's like, he's a smart guy. He has suspicions. He knows things, but you kind of get the idea that had he not been thrown into this situation of the bear and the wilderness and all this other stuff, had he, like, in New York discovered Alec Baldwin sleeping with his wife, he probably would have, like, walked off and kind of moped around and been like, well, okay. And so the idea is, like, this extreme thing happened to him. And, you know, we see if a movie like Gravity, you see, like, Sandra Bullock is just – there's a point in Gravity, spoilers, where she's just like, I'm willing to die. And then something happens. You get thrown into these extreme situations and you're like, no, you know what? I'm going to – it's that pick myself up by my bootstraps kind of thing.
Well, and if we're looking at it like that, if I went into a rewatch with this mindset of just giving a shit about Anthony Hopkins' character, I can see that. Cause like maybe his, you know, monologue about being a different person was, I'm not going to let people walk all over me anymore. Like, why should I? I'm a billionaire and I know so many things. Like, I shouldn't allow my wife to cheat on me. Cause like he had his suspicions earlier on and I shouldn't allow people to think they can just hit me up for $30 million, et cetera. And so maybe like the next time if I would watch it again, I would just give a shit about Anthony Hopkins' character. And I mean, cause like Alec Baldwin's character basically is just there to get him to, you know, push pull against his character. So maybe that's all I should give a shit about.
And I think it's also the idea is like, I think, maybe the, you know, box arts and the trailers and stuff, maybe it's one of those things where it's like, you could easily miss the point of the movie. And also because Anthony Hopkins, because he's got this kick-ass beard. And also because at the time, I wouldn't say Anthony Hopkins is a rugged guy, but you could believe him maybe kicking a little bit of ass. I kind of wonder if mentally in your head, if you were to recast this role, not for comedic purposes, but for like as a Woody Allen type where it's like this New York intellectual. And so in the setting of the city, in the setting of a New York metropolitan ritzy city, Alec Baldwin is top dog.
Right.
Where it's like, here's this nebbishy billionaire who's like, well, I read a lot and I married this beautiful girl, but I don't know, you know, what good am I in the real world? I know business, but whatever. And Alec Baldwin is like this earring wearing party going guy, and he's the king of the city in New York, you know, and he's the top dog. Suddenly thrown into an entirely different situation, being like the forest and nature. Alec Baldwin, like he's basically just surviving, and it's Anthony Hopkins that's now king of the world.
Yeah.
And so it's that kind of juxtaposition push-pull where it's like, though yes, Anthony Hopkins is married to the model, the sexual chemistry is there with Alec Baldwin. And
right, he's just there to get her a goddamn sandwich.
And you definitely get the feel at the beginning of the movie that though Anthony Hopkins seems to be footing the bill, Alec Baldwin's running the show.
Yeah. Well, or he wants to. Like, he wants everyone to remember that he's also there, pay attention to me, kind of a deal.
Yeah, and this also, I think in the dialogue, by the fact that the dialogue is very short and to the point, I think it kind of shows this isn't a realistic movie either. Also by the fact that hopefully, I mean, I know we talked about Apollo 13 people using each other's full names. Get used to Alec Baldwin saying Charles.
Yes.
Which again feels like a very play kind of thing.
Well, I thought I was
okay with that because I watched 30 Rock all the time, and so I just expected him to use
language. And, like, and I love Alec Baldwin when he falls in that bear trap. Oh, Charles. Oh, God. Charles.
You know what that reminded me of? On Austin Powers, when Will Ferrell is...
Oh, I'm very badly burned.
Badly burned. I'm not dead. I'm just hurt.
Yeah, I made a note about that sequence too. I think part of the problem for me though is, you know, Cameron, you were talking about it being cast. I think that has a lot to do with my sort of holding back with the film. Was I think that I always look at Anthony Hopkins and I think of him as being completely capable and in charge of every situation.
Yeah.
And I look at Alec Baldwin and I don't ever feel like he's in charge of something. He just always looks like, for me, he always looks like a guy that wants to be in control and never is. And so when you were saying earlier in the film where he was calling the shots and Hopkins was just going along with it, I always just was like, well, he's going along with it, but he's really the guy in charge. Like, he could stop him if he wanted to.
See, and that's what I got to.
But I think that's the point, is that if he wanted to, he does, he, but he can't, even if he wants to at the beginning of that movie, he can't. It's that kind of, it's that thing of like I said, like a week ago, I wouldn't have done anything, but now that I've been through this hellstorm, as it were.
Sure. Well, okay. Well, speaking of not doing anything, let's talk about the end real quick. And, you know, we already said about the turn where, you know, it turns out that Mickey, Elle McPherson and Alec Baldwin were sleeping together and, you know, cause she engraves this watch and blah, blah, blah. What do we make of that? He still doesn't do anything. Like he gives Mickey the watch. So letting her know that he knows, but then he defends, Alec Baldwin's character and doesn't, you know, he still doesn't actually do anything. He just, he kind of covers up the situation, is like, oh, my friends helped save my life. And that's all he says. So to me, that felt as though like, oh, well, yeah, you know, I'm still not going to make waves kind of a thing. I'm still not going to call this guy out and reveal what had happened. I'm just going to do the same sort of thing that for me he would have done at the beginning of the film. So I didn't feel like there was a lot of character development.
I don't agree.
Okay.
I feel like he is showing, I don't think he's going to fucking blow up at his wife in front of a bunch of news reporters and TV reporters.
No, I didn't want that. I just wanted, it just seemed like he was like, okay, well, you did this and it's fine.
Well, I think it's also, again, I think it's maybe that, intellectualism kind of thing. It's how to put it. I think it's that thing of it's, you're a bigger man to forgive than to hold a grudge and be vengeful. And so though, and I think it's also that more intellectual thing is that did, Alec Baldwin literally save his life? You could say when they did kill the bear, Alec Baldwin did get pounced on by that fucking bear so that Anthony Hopkins could attack him. So you could say literally, yes, Alec Baldwin did at that point save his life. But I think it's much more, it's like this situation, having these people around me, I don't think it's literally saved my life. I think it's that kind of metaphorical, I'm alive for the first time.
Okay, then I would say then there's no showing, there's only telling for that.
Well,
like, I feel like he was always capable, like because of the casting. Like, I feel like he's not learning how to do these things.
Yeah, I agree with you too. As far as the Anthony Hopkins go, they should have gotten a little more meek of a person to be kind of, to show him, going from a, you know, maybe not so bold and then at the end being able to, you know, I guess, grow a little bit as a character. Cause like, I agree with you. Like, I see Anthony Hopkins show up somewhere and I'm like, shit, this guy knows what's up. Like, he does seem very capable as a person. So I can't think of anyone right now who I would cast. But
well, I think Cameron's suggestion of Woody Allen would have been, I mean, I don't know about him in the role, but I think someone that's built like that would have been tremendous. Cause then for me, that seems like a guy who's got all the answers, but it just has zero personality and zero backbone.
Yeah.
To where Hopkins, to me, he just doesn't seem like that kind of guy.
And right, like, slap your mouth, I feel like.
So I don't know. I mean, that
well,
very
I would also
much
say, I think a big part of that is also the fact that pretty much after this movie onward, Anthony Hopkins was cast in a lot of action movies. Prior to this, he was always the intellectual guy. Seeing Anthony Hopkins fucking attacking a bear in 1997 was super weird because despite Silence of the Lambs where he peels off a dude's face, for the most part, Anthony Hopkins as an actor was very much like the intellectual. So it wasn't that crazy to see him in 1997 playing he hadn't done Zorro yet.
Sure. I mean, I'd seen him in Legends of the Fall. And
yeah.
So I just,
that's,
you know,
exactly what I thought when I saw him at that cabin. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh man, this is Legends of the Fall and shit.
I can see your point though, Cameron.
Yeah, I do. I understand. Yeah.
Like if you see something like, Magic, which is a movie I highly recommend as well, where he's also ventriloquist. He, has a creepy looking dummy.
That's weird.
Which I highly recommend that. Or something Elephant Man, which I mean, Eric, you and I watched, like, he's a powerful character in that, but it's intellectually a powerful character.
Right. Yeah.
And I think the best way to think about this is think of this character as like a meek version of that Silence of the Lambs doctor. At the beginning of this movie, this is not a character that's going to stand up for himself, and he clearly doesn't. Like, he suspects, you know, Alec Baldwin is doing something, but he doesn't really say anything. They scare him at a surprise birthday party, and he's kind of like, and people are hitting him up for money, and he doesn't really say anything other than just kind of walk away. Like, the only thing he can do is passive-aggressively on a plane go like, but how are you going to kill me? And that's the most he does. Up until the rest, and the majority of this movie, even if you think about it, up until like he has the beard, starts the fire, and then they try to kill the bear, he spends the majority of the movie just talking. Like, there's a scene where it's like they're walking on the mountains and Anthony Hopkins is just going on and on and on, and Alec Baldwin goes, hey, why don't you save your breath? And he goes, what? And that kind of a thing. So I think, like, had this all happened in one day, they hadn't met that bear, and it just been Anthony Hopkins, Steven, and Alec Baldwin on the hike, and have been like, well, we made it, we're good to go, there wouldn't have been change. But it's the fact that he went through all this with the bear, and this, you also get the feeling that probably this character has probably not done any real male bonding.
Okay. I all that being said about the problems that I did have, I loved all of the stuff, all of the bear stuff, right? Like, I thought that was really effective. Especially like once Charles starts becoming a little more unhinged and a little more aggressive and kind of losing his sense, like his losing his grasp of what's happening. Like, I didn't think it was going to quite be like this kind of a view on things. That's when I was really enjoying the film, you know, and like we were saying, the kill the bear, kill the motherfucker, that stuff. I really liked that. Some of the other things that
one man can do, another can do.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Some of the things that I, you know, was just, I don't know if it's technical or just like nitpicky things that I noticed, but I never really felt like they were ever that desperate. And this is part of the reason why I was like, oh, it's in Alaska? Okay. Because I just felt like they're like, hey, are we going to eat sometime or,
yeah.
Oh yeah, well, we'll just catch this real quick. Or
I have these cans of salmon in my pockets, or I don't know what rich people eat. I don't know.
Caviar.
There you go.
Yeah,
I think they're only supposed to have been there 3 days.
Okay.
I get the feeling because day one, they go in a circle. They fuck up and go in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
Day two is when Steven, or the end of day one essentially is when Steven gets eaten by the bear. you get the feeling either day two or day three is when they build the fire circle and then they kill the bear. And then I think pretty much they eat the bear. So I think it's probably only been like 2 or 3 days.
Okay.
At most, even. And I will say, I love the attempting to trap the squirrel.
Mm-hmm.
And Alec Baldwin's awesome cheer.
Yes, 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 yes. What did you, Cameron, have you read this wiki about the beard?
Yes, I know that story.
About Alec Baldwin refusing to shave his beard.
I wouldn't have either.
That's funny.
I just think that's such an actor thing. Like, it just, that's,
it's a great beard. It's a great beard. Let's just say right now, him and Anthony Hopkins have killer beards in this movie.
I guess so.
I love Alec Baldwin getting drunk and loading the gun.
Oh, can't do it sober, huh, Bob?
Yeah. That whole speech, turn around, Charles. That whole thing. Oh, yeah. There's so many great scenes.
See, now that's great. That's I really like that too. And I'm like, okay, well, he's clearly going to outsmart him somehow. But just him falling backwards and falling into this pit, I was like, oh. Like, whoops-a-daisy, like, what do you...
Like, he's... But that's again him using it's Anthony Hopkins, because we see, I think this might be richer on a rewatch. Anthony Hopkins, we see at that scene, at the beginning of that, of them entering that cabin, that pitfall is there. He sees it. He knows it's out there. And so it's again this character using his intelligence. Like, Anthony Hopkins grabbing the gun and punching Alec Baldwin in the face and being like, fuck you. I'm like, I guess that's more action-y, but it doesn't. It feels like that betrays the character, who they've set up. Here, he uses his smarts.
I thought he was going to change.
And he knows. You thought what?
I thought he was going to change his life. That would be life-changing.
To be a badass and beat him up.
Right.
I think it's pretty badass to walk a guy into a bear trap.
Well, and so here, like, why would Bob be scared of him? Why would he? I get that he doesn't have the
No. I do not think he's scared of Anthony Hopkins. I think it's the realization that, like, Anthony Hopkins even says it after Alec Baldwin's all fucked up. He's like, you wouldn't have done it. He's like, yes, I would have, son of a bitch. But I think it's Anthony Hopkins realizes, like, the line is right there. You can't do it sober, can you, Bob? It's the fact that it's like he doesn't really want to do this. Like, he does. He has the plan, but it's easier to plan killing a man than actually doing it as he's staring you in the face. So it's not so much he's just like he's basically confronting Alec Baldwin. Where he's like, if you're going to do it, you're going to look at me. Mm-hmm. And he knows, like, he's an intelligent enough person to see that this guy really doesn't want to do it. He walks in and he's fucking drinking while he's loading a gun to do it. And so I think he knows, like, if I step forward, this guy's going to step back. Like, he's not going to, like, bump me with the gun and shoot me in the face.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I
feel like it's all there. I don't feel like anything is, like, untrue to what the characters are.
Hmm. All right. I mean, like I said, I am being a bit hard on it. I liked it more than I didn't like it. And I really did like the action sequences. I just didn't care for the main two characters, I guess. Like, I just had a problem with them.
Well, I think what seems to keep coming up is the idea that it's like, he said he was going to change his life. Why didn't he beat anybody up? And I'm like, well, that's not what the changing the life is. That's not what it means.
Well, it doesn't mean
he's going to suddenly enter a UFC ring.
it's just like a take charge kind of a deal. I mean, I understand that he took charge of it in his own way, but I mean, I think it just goes back to, like what Eric said, that even when it looked like he was getting taken advantage of, to me, I haven't watched enough Anthony Hopkins movies where he's not completely in charge of everything, where I didn't buy that he was getting walked all over. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what was like the hardest part for me was just, I don't buy it. It's like, it'd be like casting, like Megan Fox as like a scientist or something. Like, you know, you can give her all the great dialogue and all the character changes you want, but I'm not going to buy it from her. And so I guess I'm not going to buy Anthony Hopkins being this meek character because he just, in my mind, is always a badass.
Mm. Mm. Well, there we go. There we go. So I think that I was glad that it got brought up there because I was really interested to see what it was. Because I didn't, you know, I don't hear, like you mentioned, Cameron, I don't hear people talking about The Edge, right? Like, I don't, it isn't something that come up. And you seemed very eager, so I was like, all right, great. You know, I want to see what this is about. And while I had a good time and would probably watch it again, you know, to, like, Anel watched the first half with me to have her watch the end of it. I would watch it so she could do that again, but this isn't one that I would run out and buy or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it's also for me interesting to watch it in the milieu of David Mamet, because for those who don't know, David Mamet's one of those people who, like, after 9/11 became like a super crazy conservative,
mm-hmm.
like a Dennis Miller type. And I feel like the seeds of that are in this movie a little bit, where it's like the hero of this movie is the intelligent billionaire who, put in a bad situation, will do the right thing, and the villain is the artsy fartsy photographer.
Right, yeah.
Which, as part of a milieu of who David Mamet is, I just find entertaining. But yeah.
So there you go. Alright, well, do we have anything else about that one before we move on to our final film?
It looks great on Blu-ray.
I didn't see it on, I just saw it on DVD. Okay, well, our final film, it is 2009's The Road.
Officials have declared a state of emergency.
What's happening?
I don't know. That's
not contained.
Despite the sudden drop in temperature, what you see is happening now.
What do you think is still alive?
In the world? Not very many.
It's a treat for you.
Mmm, it's bubbly.
We won't survive another winter here.
Yeah, they keep moving. It's south to the coast.
That boy looks
hungry. Why don't y'all come on the truck?
You look at him again, I'll shoot you in the head.
I don't think you killed a man in your life.
They're gonna catch up with us. They're gonna catch up with us, and they're going to kill us.
Everything depends on reaching the coast.
I told you I would do whatever it takes.
Like what? Like what?
Kill anyone who touches you, because that's my job. It's like it used to be when the sun came out.
Are we gonna die?
They're not gonna quit. We are gonna survive this.
A father and his son walk alone through burned America. Nothing moves in the ravaged landscape save the ash on the wind and water. Wow. It is cold enough to crack stones, and when the snow falls, it is gray. The sky is dark. Their destination is the warmer south, although they don't know what, if anything, awaits them there. They have nothing, just a pistol to defend themselves against the lawless, cannibalistic bands that stalk the road, the clothes they are wearing, a rusting shopping cart of scavenged food, and each other.
Okay, so this is my selection. It is based on the Cormac McCarthy novel, and it is directed by John Hillcoat, who has done another film that Cameron and I will maybe talk about sometime, eventually. And he's done a few things. He's an Australian director, and he's certainly not...
Lawless was his last movie.
Yeah, Lawless was his most recent one, and he did... The Proposition, which is the movie I alluded to earlier.
Proposition with Ryan Reynolds?
No.
Oh.
I think that's the... Isn't that the Proposal?
Yeah, I'll just be a dick.
Okay. Oh, God. Don't ever put Ryan Reynolds in a John Hillcoat movie.
and so this was my film. I watched this, I think probably in 2009 when it came out. I didn't see it in the movies, but I was definitely... Or in the theaters. But I was definitely eager to see it. You know, It's Viggo post the Cronenberg films, I believe. History of Violence.
Not counting Dangerous Method.
Right. Why would you count it? And so
it's pretty good.
I don't know. I don't like that movie really. But anyway, so
too intellectual. No one punched each other.
Yeah, that's true. I'm such a savage after all. But So this is, you know, basically sets out to be, and it, you know, it's a survival film. And when I heard the term survival film, the first thing I thought of was The Road, because this here is what I think of when I think of a no-win situation. There's nowhere to go. There's no one to help you out.
Yeah.
There's nothing. There's no there's no greater purpose. There's no life-changing, you know, plots that happen. It's simply about surviving, and that's what it's about. And that's what I really like about it. I like that you get glimpses of his former life, and you get glimpses of his wife and her choice that she makes. And you get to see just the appreciation for things that are taken so for granted now, with just, you know, simple things like soda, and about how this kid is born in this world and doesn't know any better for a lot of the things that... Or a lot of the possessions and the things that we have now. So I just love the bleakness of it. And while when I watched it, I don't go around saying, oh, see The Road, it's such a good time, it's such a good film. It's not something that I really champion, because it's not like Apollo 13, to where you don't sit and just enjoy the film. You know, I feel like it's a tough movie to sit through.
Yeah.
But I do like that at the end it does, you know, give you a happy ending. It does give you something that you can feel good about when you end the film, which is something that I don't typically go for too often. Rachel knows that I prefer to have
died.
Yeah. You didn't have a lot. Well, people died.
Right. But that's what you usually like.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, no one no one's life is for the worse after this movie. But I don't know. You know, I think that I like that they take a lot of direct quotes from the novel.
Have you read the novel?
No, you know, I have it. I have it, and I've read some of it, but I haven't found it or made the time to watch it all or to read it all yet.
Okay.
So I am looking forward to finishing it, though. So Cameron, how about you? What did you think of this one?
So I really enjoy The Road. I think it's very interesting to talk about The Road, and not just the film, but also the book. The fact that the book came out in 2006, and that was like the biggest book. And it's a very interesting book to be like the book. And I think you can always kind of maybe not all the time, but like I think there's an interesting way to chart society as to like or where things are at socially in the world in America, where it's like what's the biggest book of the year. And I think obviously 2 years ago was the 50 Shades book, so people were feeling randy. But it's very interesting that 2006, the biggest book was The Road. And it's just fascinating that it kind of just tells you where people were at in 2006, where it's like Bush just got reelected, we're in two wars, all this other stuff, and people are just like, we're all doomed. And this was a massive book. Oprah made it her book club pick.
Right, yep.
It won the Pulitzer. And it is just like the most like we're all fucked kind of book. As a movie, I really like the movie. I totally get the why this movie was not as big as the book, because it came out 2 years later. So I think, you know, there might have, or actually a couple years later.
3 years later, yeah.
3 years later, yeah. So I think the flavor for it had maybe died down a little bit. It's also it's as a plot goes, it's a very simple plot, which isn't bad, but there's not a lot to hang on to as far as a storyline goes. It's father and son are trying to get to the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. So as far as like a discussion piece, you know, as a movie goes, there's not too many things you can talk about with people. You can talk intellectually about the film as far as like character and how characters made you feel and scenes and stuff like that. But you're not going to talk about The Road commonly as a, oh, there was this great scene. You know, this isn't Mad Max.
Mm.
Of the post-apocalyptic genre. But I really like it. I think Charlize Theron with the brief work she gets to do is great. And I love the fact that she's about to be in the new Mad Max movie.
Yeah, with my boy Tom Hardy.
Yep, I like to pretend that she's the same character. Viggo, I love Viggo Mortensen. I think Viggo Mortensen's a great actor, and I love watching movies in the 90s where he's got bit parts.
Oh yeah, like
Crimson Tide,
or even Young Guns 2.
Yep, or Carlito's Way,
mm-hmm.
where he plays a handicapped person who's like, Carlito, I can't hump, Carlito. Great movie. So yeah, no, I really enjoyed the and Cody Smith McPhee, who plays the son, who was like the big discovery for this movie, who went on to go do the Let the Right One In remake.
Yeah, let me.
Which
in.
He is also very awesome in. So yeah, no, I really enjoy this movie, but it's funny. It's a movie that for me, for whatever reason, like, it's really good, but when it's over, it doesn't, I don't feel like it sticks with me for whatever reason. I can't quite pinpoint why.
Mm.
Like, it's a movie I walk away from going like, that was really good. There's a lot of solid stuff in it, but it doesn't like stick, and I'm not, I can't really pinpoint why that is.
Sure. Cruz, what about you? Had you seen this before?
No, I haven't. Okay.
What did you think of it?
Shit. I really do want to read the book because, and like, this is, I don't know, but like a quarter of the way in, I'm like, I had no idea what this was. Like, I don't, I don't know. Like, I get books by going to Barnes and Noble every once in a while. Like, I don't look at book lists or anything. So I didn't know this was a book, but about a quarter of the way through, I'm like, I bet this was a book because it's two people talking. So it was either a play or a book mm-hmm. and someone, you know, the book must have done well and they wanted to make some money off of it. And that seems like what happened. That having been said, like, as far as not sticking with you, this depressed me for like 3 days.
All right.
It's probably because I watch a lot of downer shit.
Karen's just swimming in it anyway.
Panda like four times after this. But, I mean, I wrote in one of my notes, this has no WALL-E ending, you know, the end of WALL-E, they go back to Earth and they find plants growing and think they can go back there. And, you know, you just don't see that. And you said that before. And so, to me, it has a quote-unquote happy ending, I guess, but honestly, what is the point of people continuing to try to survive if, like, I mean, I just couldn't figure that part out.
Yeah. Well, it's a happy end that this little kid isn't on his own.
Right, but he's with Guy Pearce, so.
Well, The Proposition is also a Guy Pearce film. So it was like, oh, hey, Guy Pearce. Nice.
Fucking, I was like, Guy Pearce out of nowhere has been following you and he's telling you he's a good guy. Do not go with him.
Guy Pearce is like the go-to for the Australian film.
Oh, he definitely
is. Post-apocalyptic genre. But he just did The Rover with Robert Pattinson, who was the director of Animal Kingdom, which
that's
a great movie.
Yes.
Spoiler when we're talking about the ending anyway, but why did that lady seem so worried about this kid?
Because he was going to be on his own now. And she has children, so she just has that sort of, look, I don't want you to get eaten and raped by the cannibal people, so you could just be with us.
So she was worried because they saw that his dad was injured and going to die.
Even know if that was his dad. They weren't sure. Maybe he was, like, another cannibal who was, like, taking this kid on. Because they say at the end, like, we've been following you for a while. So they were probably thinking, like, is this dude going to fucking kill this kid and rape him? Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, that was, like, because she seemed, like, super relieved that he was, like, coming with them, which, you know, I guess is understandable, but, like, I didn't, and, like, I'm kind of defending Viggo. I'm like, I didn't think he was doing that bad of a job, assholes. Like, well, he's making mistakes and stuff, but, like, he's doing the best he could, given the circumstances.
Yeah, for me, I think my, besides the ending, one of my favorite sequences is when he finds that bunker.
Yeah!
And you know, they're cleaning up. And they're eating food and they're having a great time. And I watched that, and the first time I watched this movie, I'm just kind of watching it and like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm sure, this is a nice break from just how heavy the film is.
Yeah.
And then the second time, I found myself like just enjoying the sequence again and then just not wanting the paranoia to come. Like I was like, oh no, like, just let them be in this moment for a little bit longer. Like, I'm not ready for him to think it's dangerous and for him to abandon this bunker. And I was just not ready for that. You know, like, I was, you know, feeling sorry for the situation, of course, but once they had this glimmer of hope, I was just like, oh my God, just let this stretch out for like a good 20 minutes or something. Like, I don't want to go back to that other depressing shit.
Right, and that kid's face got dirty like right after he left.
Oh yeah, it did.
Would have stayed on there, you know, stayed clean a little bit longer.
Yeah, I think this is also like, if there is a plot line to follow besides get to the beach, it's sort of the downfall of Viggo Mortensen from, and though he doesn't fall completely, it's the downfall from him trying to, you know, being the moral man, trying to tell his son like we're the good guys and all this other stuff, to where, you know, he runs into the actor, I think his name is Michael Williams, who played Omar on The Wire.
Oh, Omar, like, coming.
Yeah, being like, give me your fucking clothes and all that kind of stuff.
Oh,
leaving
yeah.
him out there, like, naked in the cold. The fact that he flare guns that dude, just yells, and now, for good reason, he got shot with an arrow. But, like, you know, yelling at the lady, be like, why are you following us? She's like, you were following us.
Yeah, right. It's paranoia everywhere. So what a world. Like,
yeah, and that's totally, like, that's when I was like, yeah, this is definitely a book, because you can totally see how that's, you know, can be subtly written, and that's why I want to read this mm-hmm. book so bad. But yeah, I get that too, like, he is one person, but, you know, the only person you have to talk to for however long is your kid, and, you know, kids suck, so.
Well, I love the fact that they find the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house.
Oh, yeah. They find that awful house.
So how long have they been walking around from when everything started, did they say?
I don't think so. And I know that for sure that the book does not say what exactly happened.
Which I think is smart.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what happened.
Yeah, and that's fine. I'm okay with that.
I don't know how long they've been.
I think you're only supposed to judge by, like, beard length on Viggo. And, like, when Charlize Theron leaves, she's got a pretty okay, trim little beard. And by the time the movie starts, she's got a big old bush beard.
Right. Yeah.
So maybe 2 months, maybe?
2 months.
Two, 3 months?
But they seem to be like, they seem to have accepted their fate. Do you know what I mean? Like, it seems like they've been out there forever.
Well, I mean, yeah, it starts with 2 months, and then how old do you think the kid is? Maybe like 8?
Yeah.
So, he's been doing it for 8 years, you know.
That's kind of where I was, because, like, she had him when there was fire.
Yeah, when...
The windows or whatnot.
Yeah, when basically the world was burning or whatever.
Which I thought she would have died in childbirth, but...
Now, what did you think of her decision, Cruz? Because this is one of the things that I thought was interesting about women in these survival films, where it's, you know, we don't have a lot of women being, especially in these movies, being much of a character. And Charlize Theron's character just says, fuck it, I'm out. Like, I'm not going through this. I can't handle it. So I'm just taking off.
Yeah. Well, initially I was like, obviously you're a fucking coward. Like, you have a son and a husband and you can't just leave and walk creepily into the winter night. But I mean, honestly, by the end of the movie, I was like, maybe she knew what was up because what, you know, you get to the ocean, it's still fucking cold there, and then you get shot and die. I mean, there isn't that light at the end of the tunnel in this story. You know, there's no, like, I don't, I like
the yeah, other there's, thing. There's no Wally plant.
Right.
There is a beetle.
There is a beetle.
Which, as silly as that might seem, that's the, like, they make a big point about, like, there's no, like, except for human beings, like, there's no more life, maybe dogs. There are dogs. But it's like.
Yeah, there are dogs.
Basically, birds and insects had died and plants had died. So them finding the beetle is essentially the closest this movie's going to get to the Wally plant.
Mm-hmm.
Is like, maybe there's hope for when the son's an adult. There's at least nature again. Society, no, but at least like maybe a sense of nature.
Right. There's going to be hope for like 2 generations from now to be okay, which, you know, if you're like that good of a person that you're like, I'm going to procreate so I can die horribly, but
And that's another reason why that mother figure would be happy to find him. Just more people, you know?
Yeah. That was my question. I wrote that down. I guess they need to repopulate, but nothing is regrowing. What's the point of repopulating? I guess.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know what? You know, and I'm always, you know, every time somebody tries to give up in a movie, I'm like, you're a pussy, but, but I got to the end of this and I'm like, I mean, there's really not a whole lot that you're going to do with your day that's going to make you happy to be alive.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
It's kind of up in the air to me.
You know, I do like just films in general where you see good people doing bad things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what I really like about Viggo is he just has this slow deterioration into paranoia. And while he's not necessarily doing something bad by... You know, leaving the bunker and by shooting the guy that he thinks is a threat to him and his child, he is being a little more paranoid than, you know, is beneficial for him.
Right.
And because, you know, he very clearly would have gone after Guy Pearce if he would have known he was around too.
Yeah. Right.
So I just think that those sort of characters are interesting to follow.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I think it's also interesting with the Charlize Theron when she's leaving. That Viggo Mortensen's outlook on it, he says in voiceover, which is, her last gift to me was being cold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is super interesting. And then, I love, Guy Pearce's teeth in this movie.
Oh, Guy Pearce's teeth. He has teeth just like this in The Proposition, too.
It's maybe just real teeth and they put fake teeth in for like.
For Iron Man 3.
Yeah, for other stuff. Like, I don't brush my teeth.
It's like, look, this is a total package situation. You just get what you get.
No deodorant. My other question is, like, would they not have all died of scurvy yet? Because, like, no fresh fruit.
Oh, the vitamin C.
I mean, their nutrition things. And then, like, I'm wondering if that scene where he gave him the Coke was in the book.
Yeah, it was, because it was Coke, because they filmed it with a bunch of different products, like Pepsi, et cetera, because they didn't know if they could get the rights to Coke, because it's Coke in the book.
Which is also like, and this is just being a dick, but like simple or complex sugars in that kid's body. I'm just throwing it out there. I was like, don't let him drink that, but he seems to be okay. And I'm like, that's okay. That's fine.
So I think I definitely want to touch on the Coke, because when this movie came out, I think a lot of people who did not read the book brought that up as like awful product placement, despite the fact that it's in the book. I think the reason for me it works, like, let's say this wasn't a book and this was just a movie. I think the reason for me it works is, A, I don't tend to mind product placement in movies. It's far less distracting. It's far less distracting than if characters make up a thing in a movie.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, like Acme soda or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you can be really bad with product placements. Just go watch any Michael Bay movie. And those product placements are horrendous. But I think for me, it's what the point of this was in this movie, which is that it's supposed to be this kind of connection to the old world kind of a thing.
Right.
And the fact that the sun had never had it and all this other stuff. So story-wise, it works. I think having Coke, because Coke is kind of, well, despite the fact that Coke is a world product.
Yeah.
It's nostalgic and Americana and stuff like that.
It's the iconic soda.
No, and it worked for me. That was just an afterthought. Like, he probably should be dying on the ground right now. But,
one of the things that these survival films
Well, if it was Diet Coke, it'd be aspartame. Yeah, it's terrible shape.
One of the things that these films don't really address as much, like, this does talk about food a lot, but where's the water coming from? You know, like, The Edge doesn't have as much of this because they could just drink the river water. But it's
right,
like...
snows ash?
Yeah, it's like an ashy thing here. So, you know, they need water just as much, if not more, than they need food.
Yeah, you can only survive like 3 days without water or something like that.
So,
I don't know. That's a good question.
Maybe they have water. Don't forget the face in the sink. They gotta wash that skin off somehow.
I guess they do take a shower.
Yeah, it's weird.
It does take a shower. So
this reminds me, and I think I brought this up before. Have you ever seen that miniseries Life After People?
No, I haven't.
Yes,
it was. You have.
Mm-hmm.
That was like that was like train wreck. I could not stop watching that. It was so amazing and frightening at the same time. It's like, I think it was like 5 different episodes, and it was like...
Yeah, it was like a week-long event.
Yeah, what would happen if people just like vanished off the face of the earth, and it was like...
It's basically like the beginning of 12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, how long would it take for the Hoover Dam to shut down? How long would it take for dogs to like break out of their house and like start roving in packs and shit? Like, it was pretty crazy.
Kind of like Russia now with all these dogs.
Right. And then they even like went to Chernobyl or something, you know, like that was a pretty crazy, and this is what that reminded me of. And you know, I was like trying to think, cause like they went into like scientific stuff about, you know, like how long it would take for stuff to regrow and stuff to break down. And like, you know, it was pretty intense.
Eric, get on that. Join the conversation.
Yeah, I really should.
I would rewatch that.
Show that to the kid.
Yeah.
Freak out her brain.
Well, you know, we did watch Iron Giant, and so we had to ruin her childhood about missiles being real. And so we're going to watch Apollo 13 while I still have it here, and we'll figure out, you know, that about the space travel stuff and about them trying to struggle to get home. And I guarantee at least a half dozen times she'll say, is this real? Could this really happen?
Hey, man,
you should show her some Cold War videos.
That'd be good.
Yeah, it's the beginning of July. Give her the nihilistic summer she's been wanting.
She's been begging for it, so I guess I'll give it to her.
Right? Yeah.
All right. We'll
find you later.
Do you guys have anything else about the road before we wrap this one up?
Sexy, skinny Viggo Mortensen.
Man, is he skinny. Woo!
And coughing up blood, that's like so attractive.
That's the thing you look for.
You can see some, look, you saw it all already in Eastern Promises, but you get to see it again in The Road.
Yeah, you want a skinnier version? Here it is.
But, like, right when I started watching this, I was like, this is going to piss me off, this movie. But it was actually a lot more of a thinker and a lot more, like, depth than what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was just going to be some Eric Williams depressing bullshit I was going to have to sit through. So
it was still
because the movie is couched in a father-son story. There's something there. The thing about Old Boy is simply, I love Old Boy, but Old Boy is couched in revenge. Movies, listening to the show, movies that Eric tends to pick that Rachel hates, that doesn't tend to be much of that core relationship about two people who at least seem to get along or love each other or like each other. Like The Vanishing, it's kind of this dick who's like, what happened to my fucking girlfriend? as opposed to, but this movie, yes, it's super depressing and super sad, but the core of the movie is a father who very much loves his son and wants to help him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's like desperation, and you know, he's trying to keep his stuff together, and so there's a lot of, you know, it's not just like, I mean, it is a lot of just walking around being sad because it's fucking sad as shit, but yeah, there's a little bit more to it. So I appreciate that on some level, Dick.
And you get some old, old blind Robert Duvall, and that's always good.
Yeah,
oh yeah. Just spitting up oranges or peaches.
Peaches. Oh, I would have been so pissed. It's like, here, guy. And then he just spits, you know, he either can't handle them or whatever.
Right.
90 my ass. You tell people that so they don't hurt you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Robert Duvall.
I do like that.
I watched this movie right after watching Days of Thunder.
Oh, really?
Nice.
That's a good Robert Duvall double feature.
That is. Wow, Days of Thunder. Holy, cold great, trickle.
Great movie. Great movie.
Dick trickle.
Something trickle.
One's real and one's the movie.
I'm illiterate. I'm an idiot. I don't know anything about cars.
Tom Cruise. All right, well, wrapping us up, if you have any comments for the show or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could find the show over at Twitter. The handle is @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79. And Rachel is @ladyzlag. We also have a Facebook page for the show where you could like it. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. And if you enjoyed the show and wanted to help us out, you could head over to our website, which is plainlabelpodcast.tumblr.com. And over there we have an Amazon box, excuse me. And over on there, if you click on the box, it takes you to Amazon's homepage. And we would like it if you bookmarked that new homepage and used that link whenever you purchase anything from Amazon. It helps us out. It doesn't change anything for you. And we would definitely, certainly appreciate that. So we do want to thank Cameron, or I want to thank Cameron. I don't know. Rachel didn't have a good time with the edge. for coming on and suggesting the theme. If people wanted to hear more from you, Mr. Rice, where would they do so?
So, yeah, for me, just go to twitter.com/JurassicAlien. You can also check out my two movie shows. One I do with Eric, which is Filmographies. By the time this comes out, the second Miyazaki episode will be out. And we have our next two directors picked.
Oh, yeah.
Which is going to be fantastic. And as of this show dropping, you can go listen to Cameron Watches Movies. The reviews are going to be Maleficent, A Million Ways to Die in the West, and 22 Jump Street.
Nice.
Two of those are garbage, and one was awesome. You have to listen to the show to figure it out.
So there you go. Well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with more survival films.